The following program from the North Carolina Reading Service is intended for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. And it's the Independent Indie Week, and I'm John Feddersen to read this week's issue, which is dated August the 28th at 2025. And we'll get right to it. And we'll start over in Durham, and this article about Ashton Place. Residents there at Ashton Place, the downtown Durham apartment complex for low-income senior residents, have quickly forged bonds in the year the building has been open. Tishia Jones, assistant property manager, says residents collect food from churches and local food pantries to stock the community fridges and the carpool to doctor's appointments or visits with nearby family members. She said during a belated ribbon-cutting ceremony for this complex this week, "We have a lot of residents over there, 51 families that have taken the time to fall in love with their homes. They've taken the time to fall in love with each other." Barbara Lennon, an Ashton Place resident, moved into her new apartment last October. She's now living out her soft life. She recently retired from Durham Public Schools after 25 years in child nutrition, though she still works part-time as a crossing guard to stay engaged with the students. Moving into Ashton Place gave Lennon a much-needed peace of mind because she didn't want her two daughters to feel burdened as she got older. And she said, "They were concerned about me moving here, and I told them I came here because I don't want to be their responsibility. I want to put myself somewhere so they don't have to do it. I want my kids to have a good life." The 51-unit affordable housing complex is open to residents ages 55 and up whose household income is at or below 60% of the area median income. It offers residents an assortment of amenities, kitchen appliances, storage lockers, community spaces and events, free Wi-Fi. And the building is also a stone's throw away from the downtown Durham Transit Station, which accommodates many of the same residents who would qualify for the low-income housing offered by Ashton Place. And tenants get to share in downtown living, usually reserved for those in Durham's growing supply of high-rise apartments and luxury residential towers. Durham City Council member Mark Anthony Middleton said, "We're not just putting affordable, high-quality housing downtown, but putting it in a place and in a manner that is indistinguishable from the market-rate apartments around it, indistinguishable from an aesthetic point of view, from a material point of view. Durham is an attractive destination for young people looking to start a job or family. The average median age is around 34, but a majority of the new housing, both apartments and standalone homes, can be difficult to access for older residents who are on a fixed income or need varying levels of additional services like transportation or health care support that market rate housing doesn't always accommodate. After a lifetime of working to build a life, Durham residents need access to homes where they can age in place without sacrificing basic needs." Self-Help's Director of Real Estate, Dan Levine, says, "We're opening doors of opportunity, dignity, comfort, and safety for people who live in these homes and who have contributed to Durham for many decades and continue to contribute. They have put in the work, and we owe that back to them, to put in the work for them." Construction for Ashton Place began in March of 2023 and was co-developed by DHIC Incorporated and Self-Help Ventures Fund. A complex web of sources pushed the project over the finish line, including city, state, and federal investment, community partners like Oak Foundation, Duke University, and A.J. Fletcher, and various financial institutions like the Royal Bank of Canada, J.P. Morgan Chase Bank, and North Carolina Housing Finance Agency. Construction costs rose over the course of the project due to tariffs and other market uncertainties, but the commitment from the funding partners kept that project viable and on schedule, said Levine. Quote, if any one of them had gone away, this project wouldn't happen. All those partners really stepped up even more to keep this project on track and going, and we're really grateful. Vincent Price, president of Duke University, said during the ceremony that Duke would remain dedicated to partnering on issues like housing and health economic mobility in a variety of ways. Residents have called on Duke to step up its commitment to Durham amid the university's own financial setbacks due to federal funding cuts. Willard Street Apartments, the affordable complex adjacent to Ashton Place, opened in 2021. Many of the same organizations collaborated on both locations. In 22, Willard Street project was recognized by the North Carolina Housing Finance Agency, receiving that agency's top award for excellence in affordable housing. Levine said, in Durham, tens of thousands of residents vote literally at the ballot box in support of candidates who support affordable housing, in support of affordable housing bonds, in support of donating city land for affordable housing, not just here but throughout the community. I want to acknowledge them as partners, particularly in an environment where we need local governments to keep stepping up and doing more to support affordable housing. We could not be in a better place than the fellow neighbors we have in Durham for that. The city of Durham has nearly exhausted the funding it secured through the affordable housing bond that voters approved in 2019. Land in Durham is expensive, especially prime real estate in and around downtown. City and county officials have been working together to create an inventory of publicly owned land to assess whether more affordable projects like Ashton Place could be possible. Selling the land to build affordable housing elsewhere in Durham is a possibility, but downtown real estate is already scarce. Middleton said, there were a lot of folks who pushed back against the proposition of taking the most expensive real estate we have and using it for affordable housing. Without the land, the likelihood of building more affordable housing in the urban center drops significantly. Middleton says that Durham residents who believe in affordable housing for all and cultural diversity are prepared to invest in their values, even if it comes at a cost, saying, that's who we are, because we believe in shared economic prosperity, because we don't want homogeneous neighborhoods. We want vibrant neighborhoods where all kind of folk from different educational strata and different social economic levels mixed together. The City Council could revisit another housing bond in the near future as its neighbors over in Raleigh ponder the same question. After the ribbon cutting, Middleton told Indy that it is up to the voters, not City Council, to choose whether they want to make the investment. Quote, it's up to the people. It's expensive, and it takes political will. Did you see that view up there? You know what people pay in the city for a view of their skyline. Well, another positive article from Durham. Downtown Durham is going to get a new art house cinema. Over its hundred-some years, 118 West Parrish Street has been home to a handful of commercial ventures, bicycle shop, furniture store, or home goods store. Next summer, it's poised to offer something new to downtown Durham, an art house cinema. Alex Manis and Jim Haverkamp, that duo behind the experimental art space called Shadowbox Studio, say they hope to open this venue next summer. It's named Skin and Bones Theater. The 50 to 60 seat flex space will be used for film programming, lectures, readings, and other events. Shadowbox Studio, located off Club Boulevard, will continue to operate separately. Manis says of the plans, "There's not a lack of performance space in town, but there could be more. We've gotten such an enthusiastic response over the years with what we have been doing over at Shadowbox." Cinched between two of Durham's most iconic locations, the Unscripted Hotel and the Mechanic and Farmers Bank, the three-story building is owned by real estate group Eno Ventures and is currently being renovated. Skin and Bones Theater will occupy the first floor, which most recently was leased by gift store Chet Miller, now located off Durham Chapel Hill Boulevard, and by local press Horse and Buggies Storefront Gallery, which owner Dave Wofford closed earlier this summer. Manis and Haverkamp are artists and filmmakers themselves. Manis works as a freelance photographer. Haverkamp teaches the film department at Duke University and have witnessed firsthand the evolution of both downtown and the local arts scene. They ran the first scrappy iteration of Shadowbox off Washington Street before the rental market necessitated to move further north in 2015 to the venue's current enterprising location, a storage unit. Haverkamp says, "We miss the Durham of 25 years ago when we first moved here, as everyone who's been around can attest. I think for both of us, honestly, the loss of Man Bites Dog Theater is something we still think about. Both Alex and I did a ton of work there. It felt like a community space and creative hub, and we just want to try to contribute to that." Indeed, the landscape of the downtown core has changed significantly over the past two decades. Revitalization and a spike in the rental market pushed many longtime businesses out, while remote work has continued to stall daytime foot traffic downtown. As with many cities around the country, the downturn in local consumer spending is at odds with its density. Downtown Durham Incorporated's 2025 State of Durham report estimated that nearly 9,900 people live in or adjacent to downtown, a number that's estimated to keep growing, with the April report citing 13 developments under construction that will add over 1,200 market-rate units downtown. A new business in an uncertain economy is certainly a risk, but Manis says, "We wouldn't be doing this if we didn't think it was a solid idea." He and Haverkamp have kept Shadowbox's programming humming for years. Haverkamp and his wife, Joyce Ventimiglia, also co-founded and ran a small film festival, Strange Beauty Film Festival, from 2010 to 15. Manis and Haverkamp say they feel buoyed by the slow resurgence of mixed-use art spaces in the area, citing spots like Mettelson, North Star Church of the Arts, and Perfect Lovers. In the past 2 years, Night School Bar and Queen Street Magic Boat have also opened as neighborhood arts hubs. Haverkamp says, "I'm encouraged because I feel like small, weird spaces have been slowly coming back. We just see this as just another voice to add to that." They plan to stick to basics, in keeping with the venue names, which started as jokey shorthand and stuck. "We really want it to be very simple and direct, you know, very bare bones. Limitations with the location of the building's water pipes, for instance, led to an early decision. They will forego selling ice and fountain drinks at the concession counter and will trust that cans and bottles will suffice. The real thing they hope people will turn out for is the kind of unconventional events that Shadowbox has steadily produced for years, as well as a programming format and space that invites people to linger. After all, a random conversation at the cinema is the way that those two collaborators met. As they tell it, their friendship began while waiting in line for the bathroom at the Rialto Theater in Raleigh. Manis said, I think that people are hungry for this kind of programming. They want something more than just going to movies. It might be interesting to have, like, a talk with the film or a pairing with a band or musician, more of an evening's worth of entertainment rather than just going and coming back. Come over to Skin and Bones and hang out with us for a little while before and after the film. Manis and Haverkamp plan to launch a fundraising campaign in the spring. In the meantime, there's no shortage of movies, live performances, and other events at Shadowbox. Duke bus driver is at risk at losing protected immigration status. A popular Duke University bus driver said Tuesday he will visit U.S. Senator Ted Budd, Republican of North Carolina, and state leaders next week to ask them to intervene on his behalf. Luis Alonso Juarez, a Honduran who is well known across Duke's campus for operating a party bus, made the announcement outside the regulated bookstore on 9th Street, surrounded by students, faculty, and others who said he brought joy to their lives by playing lively music on his route. A scheduled press conference on the Duke campus was canceled and moved to the bookstore after Duke University officials threatened Juarez with disciplinary action if the press conference was held on campus, according to Siembra NC, a grassroots immigrant advocacy group. Supporters were asked to ride Juarez's buses this week in a show of solidarity, and Juarez will travel to Raleigh on September 4 to meet with Bud and leaders of the General Assembly. In 1998, according to a press release shared by Siembra NC, Juarez was granted temporary protected status. That status will expire September the 8th due to a Trump administration order terminating TPS protection for Honduras. Because Juarez entered the U.S. without inspection or authorization and is not married to a U.S. citizen, under current immigration law, he does not qualify for another form of protection like a work visa or a green card. And without this status, Juarez and as many as 51,000 other Hondurans across the country will be eligible for removal, according to Siembra NC. Nikki Marin Baena, co-director of Siembra, said Juarez has been working at Duke for 19 years, but because of these decisions made by the Trump administration, thousands of people are about to lose their protective status. Speaking through an interpreter, Juarez said he wants to remain in the United States because he likes his work as a bus driver. The 54-year-old previously worked in construction, but said it is unrealistic at this point for someone his age to return to that kind of work. I'm all over the campus, he said, and they, students, faculty, and colleagues, like my work and they want me to keep doing it. Immigration attorneys have advised Juarez that his only short-term path to retain a work permit would be for the Trump administration to grant an extension of protection from removal, much like his first term. In 2021, President Donald Trump issued a deferred enforced departure designation for Venezuelans present in the U.S. on or before January 20th of 2021, which granted them 18 months of deferred removal and employment authorization. He has twice extended such protections for Liberians. Andrew Willis Garces, a senior strategist for Siembra, said the organization is unaware to what extent Duke has reached out to help Juarez or others who might be in a similar predicament, saying, right now, they're immigrants about to just lose their paycheck, which means they lose their mortgages and could mean they lose all kinds of things. And it doesn't look to me like Duke's leaders have yet taken the step of trying to figure out how they can help these workers, even if they can't help them with legal status or their work permits. What else could they do? Juarez has become a popular figure on the Duke campus. He was profiled in the Duke Chronicle last month. 477 students, faculty, and staff submitted letters of support for Juarez to Duke Visa Services, asking the university to take action on his behalf. Several students showed up on Tuesday to support him. Duke senior Joyce Thomas has been riding Juarez's bus since she was a freshman. Thomas said Juarez has helped build community at the university and that he and other staff members are not replaceable. Thomas said, without people like Louise, I would not feel how I do at Duke. Professor Katja Waslowski, an anthropologist and dancer, said she met Juarez last spring after she began riding his bus. Waslowski was taken by his cheerfulness and the fabulous music he plays, she said. She's working on a plan to incorporate Juarez into her curriculum, but the two couldn't get together to pull it off, she said. Quote, this is an illustration about how the workers at Duke are not invisible. They are not extracurricular. They're not doing work behind the scenes. They are integral to Duke education, to our students' education. Members of the Union of Southern Service Workers also showed up to support Juarez. Mama Cookie, a community organizer and retired food service worker, said, this is an attack on all workers. If we allow this to happen and not stand in unity with Luis, we're going to be in trouble. Nashon Blunt, a Duke housekeeper, noted Juarez immigration issues come amid heavy layoffs at the university due to a Trump administration threat to reduce funding over race-related discrimination claims. U.S. Education Secretary Linda McMahon and Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. allege the university engaged in, quote, the use of race preferences in Duke's hiring, admissions, and scholarship decisions. Blunt said, I would like Duke to stand up to their end of the bargain and actually take care of their workers and take care of the city that helped build them. If you can't serve your community or serve the state where you have an establishment, there's no point in you being here in the first place. Durham City Councilwoman Javiera Caballero vowed the city will stand by Juarez and other immigrants, saying, we all have to work diligently right now to protect our workers in the city and at Duke and across the country. We are ready to fight and stand up. It's going to take every single one of us. Well, I better move us for a little bit over to Chapel Hill in Orange County. And after Tropical Storm Chantal, after it sent 4 feet of water surging through Camelot Village in Chapel Hill, tenants displaced from that condominium complex are struggling to find new housing, and some face homelessness when their temporary shelter at a Durham Comfort Inn expires next week. Six of the tenants, backed by the Triangle Tenant Union, held a press conference Wednesday to demand that their individual landlords return their July rent payments, reimburse security deposits, and cancel their leases. The tenants also called for more assistance from local governments with relocation efforts. After Chantal displaced Camelot Village, tenants were initially housed at its emergency shelter at Smith Middle School before moving to Comfort Inn and a nearby Red Roof Inn. The hotel stays have been covered thus far by $100,000 that the town of Chapel Hill gave Orange County from its emergency fund. At the press conference, tenants said they've been told the funding runs out on August 29 and that they'll need to find somewhere else to go. Jessica Tickles said, I'm going to be homeless, pretty much, because I haven't found no place to go I can afford. I had to take off work to find housing, so it's like starting from zero again. At least 26 tenants still need to be relocated, with only four having been successfully rehoused, according to Triangle Mutual Aid. Orange County Community Relations Director Will Glenn told Indy in a Thursday email that the hotel funding has been extended several times and it's possible that may occur again, although it's, quote, too early to determine that today. He wrote, no resident will be left without a housing plan when the temporary funding ends. He added that county staff are, quote, working intensively with each household through personalized case management. Finding new housing costs money for application fees, moving expenses, new deposits many Camelot tenants don't have, especially those whose individual landlords have yet to return rent payments and security deposits, despite their homes being uninhabitable since July the 7th. One of the tenants still waiting for money back is Heather Gibbs, who moved into her condo in April through county housing assistance. She has spent over $300 in non-refundable application fees trying to find new housing. So far, she has nothing to show for it. Some apartments she's applied to have failed inspections, while others have multi-year waiting lists. Gibbs' landlord at Camelot is Richard Kunst. In a phone call, Kunst told Indy, quote, "The deposit is taxpayer money," referring to the facts the county put down the money for the security deposit, and that, quote, "it's yet to be resolved how it should be distributed." Camelot Village was built in 1967 in a flood plain near Bolin Creek. That complex has flooded repeatedly over the decades. Quinton Simmons, a tenant who has lived there for 7 years, said at the press conference, "The place is a death trap. I'm not going back there." He said that while his landlord has offered to return his security deposit, he hasn't been able to collect it because he doesn't have a forwarding address to provide. Dale Wildell, a 62-year-old tenant with a prosthetic leg, was more fortunate. His landlord promptly returned his July rent and security deposit, he said. The night of Chantal, Wildell barely escaped his apartment as his prosthetic came off in the rushing current. Like other tenants who spoke at the press conference, Wildell said he owes his life to good Samaritans who lived near his unit. Quote, "If it wasn't for the neighbors coming to rescue me, I wouldn't have made it out. You fall in that current in my condition, even though I was a great swimmer, you're gone." The fire department did arrive with motorized rafts, but they weren't able to navigate the current, according to Wildell. As tenants try to rebuild their lives, Triangle Mutual Aid volunteers have been providing nightly meals at the Comfort Inn and helping tenants navigate paperwork required for assistance, a particular challenge for those who lost all their documents in that flood. Devin Gilgore, a volunteer with Triangle Mutual Aid, says when you go to apply for the county grants and you go to DSS to get a voucher, they want your birth certificate, they want your driver's license, they want documentation of who you are, and these people don't have any of that. He continued, "We'd appreciate it if the city and county could step up a little bit and help, because all of this is being done by mutual aid, the same way it was mutual aid that neighbors helped neighbors get out of the apartments." Chapel Hill Communications Director Alex Carrasquillo told Indy that beyond working with Orange County to provide funding for displaced residents, the town stands ready to expedite permits as property owners make repairs. Chapel Hill's CARE team has also been available to help tenants make connections to a range of resources, according to Carrasquillo. He also said the town has had discussions with property management about working with them to pursue a FEMA buyout, in which the government would purchase the property, demolish the condos, and leave that flood-prone land undeveloped, should they receive a presidential disaster declaration. But securing a FEMA buyout is not a simple task. Three past attempts were unsuccessful due to lack of unanimous sign-off from property owners and funding constraints. Next, statewide, this article pertains to North Carolina teachers who spend hundreds of dollars on school supplies each year. Triangle organizations are working to split the bill. There's a decent chance that the assortment of items in any North Carolina public school classroom, pencils, rulers, even those popular hang-in-there inspirational cat posters, were paid for out of the pocket of a teacher making a starting salary of $41,000. Tools for Schools, organized by Nonprofit Wake Ed Partnership, is one of the local programs hoping to cover some of those costs. Keith Poston, president of Wake Ed, told Indy at a media event organized by Raleigh Congresswoman Deborah Ross, at Wake Ed's Capitol Boulevard location, which sort of looks like a school supply section of a small department store, quote, "In our first 2 years, we gave away $1.6 million in new school supplies. There's 10,000 teachers in Wake County. Last school year, we served more than 5,000 of them." Alia Everett, a restorative learning lab instructional assistant at Wake County Public Schools, was one of those educators who showed up to pick up some free equipment this week, saying, "It's really important just to get stocked up on those necessities." She was looking at boxes of markers. She estimates she spends several hundred dollars a year on supplies, every year. As she moves around the well-stocked shelves, she keeps track of the cost of items, recorded in points. Educators get 100 points per visit and can make one visit per quarter. Small items, like a pack of markers or a canister of Clorox wipes, cost only a few points, while bigger grabs like a large sticky note easel could be upwards of 40 points. Poston, Durham's DPS Foundation, similarly just finished up its annual Crayons to Calculators Fill That Bus Challenge, which the organization estimates helped teachers save an average of $400 last year. Poston said, "Every time a teacher comes in the shop, they typically leave with anywhere from $150 to $200 worth of supplies." Even with the help of organizations like Wake Ed and DPS Foundation, teachers across the state will fork over an estimated average of $1,600 this year on supplies for their classroom. That's among the highest in the nation, in a state that also has some of the lowest teacher pay. And prices are only going up, as noted by Representative Ross, who stopped by the supply store to bag some erasers for educators and to rail against Republicans at the state and federal level. Quote, "It's been going up because of inflation. It's been going up because of the tariffs, because a lot of supplies are not made in the United States of America. Congress and the legislature have not been providing enough money for our public schools, and in some cases, clawing that money back. That is simply wrong." Poston said that barring a sustained, significant investment from the state and federal government, nonprofits, and the private sector will have to keep stepping up as much as possible to bear the costs for students whose families may not be able to afford supplies. Poston said, "We'd rather not be doing this. We'd rather be focusing on literacy or something else. But in the meantime, we're going to be here to help our teachers. If the teachers don't have what they need, they can't teach. And if students don't have what they need, they can't learn." Well, here's an article unrelated to a town specifically in North Carolina, but certainly an area. A dozen black cows graze by the side of Sharon Harris Road on 190 acres just south of Old U.S. Highway 1 in New Hill, a rural, unincorporated town in western Wake County. Some rustic-looking farmhouse structures sit further back on this property, framed by gently sloping hills. The Western Wake Sewage Treatment Facility sits directly to the west of that farmland, and Duke Energy's Sharon Harris Nuclear Power Plant is located just 3 miles to the south. "We are a terrorist attack waiting to happen," remarked a resident of nearby Jordan Point neighborhood at a community meeting Thursday afternoon, "and we're surrounded by schools," another added. I mean, this is just such a recipe for disaster. Jordan Point is a decade-old master-planned community that features more than a few million-dollar-plus homes. At the neighborhood's poolside cabana, a group of two dozen residents discussed how best to organize opposition to a massive data storage facility proposed for the Sharon Harris Road farm property. They wouldn't be the only ones affected. Two more large communities are planned on either side of Jordan Point, each with hundreds of new homes. Just 2 days earlier, Jordan Point residents met with the developer and learned more about the project, stoking their concerns. That facility, according to notes taken by a resident and reviewed by Indy, is a proposal from Maryland-based developer Natelli Investments, LLC. Preliminary plans call for 4 to 6 buildings up to 75 feet tall and 83 megawatt generators on the site that would be used during power outages and tested weekly. A 60-foot buffer would surround the perimeter of the property. As large data facilities pop up across the country to power technology and increasingly run ever more powerful AI, residential communities are grappling with their impacts. These include the staggering amounts of water, up to millions of gallons a day, and electricity they require. It's not clear how many data storage facilities are located in North Carolina. The state doesn't keep an official list, and some of their locations, including those housing government data, are kept secret. But the News and Observer found, quote, data centers exist, humongous and modest, in rural counties and in cities. Apple, Meta, Google, and Microsoft all have large centers in western North Carolina, and the Triangle is already home to some small facilities, including Tier Point in Research Triangle Park, Cyrus One in Durham, and a new American Tower facility along Chapel Hill Road in West Raleigh that opened this spring. Concerns voiced at Thursday's meeting at Jordan Point ranged from health and quality of life impacts, including air pollution from burning fossil fuels, noise and light pollution, to the costs and environmental repercussions of using energy from the power grid and clean water from the treatment facility. According to notes from the developer's meeting with the neighbors on August 19th, Natelli Investments, LLC, is a third-generation real estate firm that shifted to data center projects 5 years ago and has built similar facilities from South Carolina to Maryland. The attorney for Natelli Investments, Beth Trahos of Fox Rothschild LLP, who is listed as the contact person for the project, did not respond to questions from the Indy sent on Friday. On Tuesday, a day after the story published, a spokesperson from North Carolina-based RLF Communications sent a media statement from the developer, Michael Natelli, executive vice president of Natelli Holdings, confirming the company is in the early stages of planning a data center on the site. The statement read, "This project is designed for future industrial development by the town in the town of Apex's comprehensive plan and is an ideal location for this type of development that's critical to North Carolina's continued growth and economic success." Continuing, more than $1 billion will be invested to bring this project to life, including state-of-the-art measures to mitigate noise, use non-potable water drawn from the wastewater system, and securing power directly from Duke Energy. We look forward to sharing additional information when we file rezoning and annexation applications with the town of Apex, and we will continue to gather input from the community as we proceed with this project. The company has been evaluating that parcel of land at 4232 Sharon Harris Road for over a year, the representatives told neighbors at the meeting. The proposal, requires the 189-acre site to be annexed into the town of Apex, followed by a rezoning from residential to light industrial that require a text amendment to the town's development ordinance to add a definition of what a data storage facility is. The developer aims to file that annexation, zoning application, and text amendment by September the 2nd, according to a slide from a presentation that the Indy viewed. According to Wake County Real Estate Records, the property is still owned by Michael L. Goodwin. It's not clear whether the sale of the property is contingent on the developer getting the annexation and rezoning. It's also unclear why Natalia Investments wants to be annexed into Apex, rather than asking for the rezoning from Wake County. Representatives for the developer pitched the community on the project's economic benefits, neighbors say, including an estimated $10 million in annual tax revenue for Apex and Wake County, plus an additional $1.2 million in tax revenue to the state, $300 million in compensation for construction labor, and an $850 million in additional economic contributions like lodging, food sales, materials cost during construction period. According to the neighbor's notes, the proposed facility would require around 250 megawatts of energy. That's the equivalent of 25% of Sharon Harris Nuclear Plant's 1 gigawatt output that will come from the existing energy distribution grid. Duke Energy is conducting a feasibility study to confirm the power availability, the results of which might not be shared publicly. But neighbors say it seems clear that the facility will require more power than what's currently available. Jordan Point resident Sarav Arunchalam, an adjunct professor in environmental science at UNC's Gillings School of Global Public Health, said, "From a financial point of view, there's likely going to be some infrastructure upgrades, and there is a cost aspect of infrastructure upgrades, which is most likely going to pass through to the communities." Arunchalam notes that while North Carolina used to rely on burning coal in the last 2 decades, the state has come to rely more on natural gas. And he says, natural gas is still a fossil fuel, and if you're going to have excess capacity somewhere in the grid in Duke Energy's portfolio, then it's going to lead to excess emissions of carbon, excess emissions of other pollutants which cause both air quality and health risks in the near term, while carbon dioxide impacts are more of a long-term issue for climate change. The generators, too, could require burning fossil fuels, potentially diesel, for power. Exposure to diesel exhaust can inflame the body's T cells and alter their function, which can be harmful to people with asthma and could trigger autoimmune and allergic responses. And the use of treated wastewater sourced from Western Wake Regional Water Reclamation Facility, which is jointly owned by the Apex and the town of Cary, could also contribute to air pollution. That water could be pumped through pipes housed inside the facility to cool machines, powering the operations of cloud computing, data analysis, or the functions of tech corporations, governments, and other entities storing data and providing internet services. According to that neighbor's report out from the meeting with the developer, about one-third of the water the facility utilizes will evaporate, and the rest will cycle back to the treatment plant. Evaporated water mixes with air pollutants, Arunchalam explains, and eventually is redeposited on homes, plants, trees, and the ground, which could harm humans and ecosystems. He says they may have some other health impacts based upon just a deposition of what gets evaporated and the potential mix of air pollution in the evaporated water. Jordan Point residents and other New Hill neighbors are organizing to speak against the proposed storage facility at the Apex Town Council meeting Tuesday evening. They've also started a petition opposing the data center with more than 1,000 signatures and are working on launching a website and raising money to hire legal representation. All right, who wants to hear an article about the chocolate botanist? Well, you're going to hear it from me. Derek Haynes shares his Durham apartment with hundreds, yes, actual hundreds of plants. Green leaves stretch out from pots of all shapes and sizes, with many illuminated under purple grow lights. Smaller species sit in aquariums that Haynes turned into miniature greenhouses, while larger plants, ranging from sunflowers to a mint variety called Berries and Cream Mint, bask in sunlight on his small balcony. Haynes estimates there are about 300 to 500 plants around his apartment on a good day, and at least 200 at any time. "I love all of you," he calls out to a packed shelf behind him. Known online as the Chocolate Botanist, Haynes shares his plants and educates people about botany via social media platforms like TikTok, YouTube, Facebook, and X. His largest audience stems from Instagram, where he has nearly 75,000 followers. Frequent content includes him casually chatting to the camera as he debunks plant care myths, explaining the science behind fertilizers, growth methods, and smiling for selfies with his leafy greens. 35-year-old knows he may not look like a textbook scientist. Standing at 6'3", Haynes has long dreadlocks and a full beard, and you'll never catch him in a white lab coat. He received a Bachelor of Science in Plant Biology from North Carolina State and works in pharmaceuticals when he isn't filming his content. But before any of that, he says he was just a kid growing up in New Bern with a fascination for the world around him. He spent his childhood watching TV shows like Captain Planet, Bill Nye the Science Guy, and Beakman's World. Although Haynes was always fascinated by the tall cane grasses and fuzzy dandelions around him, he could count the number of black botanists he knew on one hand. None of them were alive for him to look up to. He tells the Indy, "I started going for it and then started working with well-meaning white people who would disillusion me from things I wanted to do. They only saw my complexion and what they put onto it. I knew I had to do something different. That's where, with this platform, I show all people, but especially my black and brown people, hey, look, this is what a scientist looks like." Currently, Haynes is working on a paid service he's calling Seed TV, a long-form video series with episodes posted on Vimeo. He describes the series as a black analog to PBS. The idea for Seed TV was developed as a counter to the lack of black voices in educational programming, instead of those voices being pushed aside or featured as an afterthought. He wants to bring them to the forefront of scientific conversations. He says, "I said, versus me continually begging for some TV series to see me, I'll just make my own. And then I'll also make sure I feature people who, regardless of how many followers you have, I don't care how big your platforms are, just make some dope content. Let's talk about plants." When Haynes was in elementary school, he used to go to his local store and buy 3-liter bottles of soda. He discovered that if he filled the empty bottle with water, leaves, bark, and grass, then it would begin to expand and foam. He realized the concoction was reacting with the sun's heat, so to speed things up, he decided to place it by the floor vents of his childhood trailer. To make it in faster, he then covered the bottle with a pile of clothes. The next morning when he went to school, he says his grandmother began to wonder what the source of a rotten smell was. She got her answer when that bottle completely exploded from the carbonation. Haynes still creates fermented drinks with his plants, though they're in proper containers and look significantly more appetizing than that childhood concoction. And he says, the scientist, inquisitive, questioning, creative person I am now is the same as when I was a child, except that I have limits. But the child didn't. He pops open an orange-colored bottle before pointing up to the ceiling that's faintly stained from past fermented experiments. Child me is still blowing things up. Next, from Raleigh, at least, North Carolina officials and former Consumer Fraud Protection Bureau director talk scams, fraud, and consumer protection in the Trump era. North Carolina Secretary of State Elaine Marshall sat at the front of a nondescript conference room and brandished an assortment of colorfully packaged THC gummies. To Marshall's right sat Congresswoman Deborah Ross and the former director of the federal CFPB, Rohit Chopra. To Marshall's left, a contingent of attorneys from the North Carolina Justice Center. The Secretary of State was not offering Wake County's congressional representative an edible. She was making a point about the dangers of trademark infringement. All the gummies were packaged to look like candy, Starbud, Stoner Patch, Stony O, and most frequently, Doritos, which looked just like the real thing, save for an inconspicuous label. Marshall said, "You and I think it's funny. But there's a documented case in the Virginia Beach area where a 4-year-old consumed everything in that package and died." As part of its broader mandate to strengthen the state's economy, Marshall's office is charged with protecting people and businesses from financial fraud, which can mean investigating counterfeit goods, warning against financial scams, and prosecuting violators. She's seen more than her fair share of scams since she took office 28 years ago, and right now they're proliferating dangerously. Fake charities that capitalize on environmental disasters, counterfeit pharmaceuticals, dubious text messages and robocalls, illegal price hikes, online pig butchering schemes targeting vulnerable and elderly people. Meanwhile, the Trump administration has kneecapped the federal Consumer Financial Protection Bureau by stopping work at the agency and repeatedly attempting to fire nearly all its employees. Without a fully functional CFPB, there's minimal federal protection against the wave of suspicious financial practices and products inundating consumers. Marshall, Ross, and Chopra, who President Biden tapped to lead CFPB in 21 and President Trump fired this February, gathered with a handful of lawyers and consumer advocates in Raleigh on Thursday to talk about potential solutions. It took most of the allotted hour for them to catalog the extent of the problem. Chopra saying, right now we see a CFPB and a Federal Trade Commission, a Justice Department, really in a coma, not enforcing anything. Peter Gilbert, litigation director for the NC Justice Center, chimed in, "We have a great relationship with our Attorney General's Consumer Affairs Division. We do what we can, but it's never going to be enough to fill the gap in the absence of robust federal enforcement." States could theoretically enact more stringent consumer protection laws to counterbalance the federal oversight vacuum. North Carolina already has some solid protections on the books, according to the NC Justice Center's Jason Pickler, including a 2009 law that prevents debt buyers from getting default judgments against vulnerable borrowers. However, Pickler said, the current climate in the legislature doesn't allow us to pass these kind of laws. What we're trying to do is hang on the enforcement mechanisms that we have and use those the best we can for consumers. North Carolina doesn't do enough to protect tenants, the officials said, even though housing and the cost of living are top issues. They discussed how in-demand housing is being bought up by LLCs, Prices are going up, and a decimated federal Department of Housing and Urban Development is not regulating evictions. Wake County had almost 20,000 evictions in 2024, according to the NC Housing Coalition. Chopra said, I'm worried that the eviction tactics of corporate landlords really pushes the edge. Homeowners, meanwhile, are vulnerable to sky-high and climbing insurance rates and predatory loans. With federal regulators asleep at the wheel, the North Carolina officials are using consumer education to fill the gap. Marshall saying, I can't prosecute our way out of the problem, so we've got to use education as a strong, important component. Nonprofits like Legal Aid and the NC Justice Center also play an important role, but this summer, the state legislature passed and Governor Stein signed a bill that, among other things, freezes a major statewide legal aid fund. NC Justice Center stands to lose about $1.2 million a year as a result, according to Interim Executive Director Dana Mangum. With the current climate for consumer protection and legal aid looking so bleak, many of the officials in the room seem to be looking to a post-Trump future for a sliver of hope. Chopra said, we need you to stay alive and come back bigger and more powerful, he told the Justice Center contingent. Ross agreed. We're planning for when the take-back happens. I hope I have time to rush through this last little article by Lena Geller, which is an Ask Indy. Where can I eat with my young kids? I have about a minute. I'm looking for places to eat with my young kids. We aren't trying to take them to breweries, but we're looking for space where they can learn how to behave in a restaurant and try new foods without necessarily ruining other people's meals if they don't get it right the first time. For building restaurant skills, the answer in a low-stakes environment, look for spots that are already a little noisy on the inside, like Toro Pizza in Durham, or have a small array of outdoor seating. That way you can't hide out and make a huge mess, but there's enough of a cushion you aren't disrupting date nights in the event of a meltdown. Places with open kitchens or interactive elements can work wonders for behaviors when kids are able to watch their noodles being pulled or choose what goes into their bubbling hot pot. They're engaged enough to forget about staging chaos. Well, and I have to stop there. That article was just barely begun, but they give you several other ideas which you could find if you go to indieweek.com. And take a look through all the issues, including this one, and the past issues, too. Meanwhile, John Federson and the North Carolina Reading Service will bring you the next Indie Week in a week. So thank you very much for listening, and see you soon.